Welcome to Older Women Live. I'm Rosemary Wally. This series features women's voices from across the globe and revisits over a decade of interviews I've done with a variety of people involved in social justice issues. Older Women Live provides background to contemporary issues like age, race, gender, and the impact of globalization on women's lives. In this episode, we discuss the traditional images of women in Western society, mothers and sex symbols. We start by speaking to Andrea O'Reilly, a professor of gender, sexuality and women's studies at York University in Toronto. Andrea is a prolific writer and researcher on the topic of motherhood and the social construct of what she calls intensive mothering.
How has motherhood changed in the last 20 years?
Good question and a hard question. I teach a course at York University, a full-year women's studies course. When I open my course, I often ask my students, what is a good mother today? What is she supposed to look like? What is she supposed to do? What traits is she supposed to have? And I'm quite amazed how much these students are in agreement. And many of them are not mothers. They're young, you know, women, not yet considering motherhood. But they agree. They, even though they're not mothers, they've been already very much affected by the dominant, what I call the dominant discourse or the dominant ideology. And they all say, well, a mother should be, you know, a certain age, right? You can't be too young anymore. So you have to be, oh, in your late 20s to your early 30s. If you're 18, you're too young. If you're 40, you're too old. A mother is supposed to be patient. She's never to anger. Her whole life is to center on her children. They must come first. Mother love is considered timeless, the best. Any care given other than the biological mother is seen as insufficient. And that includes even husbands, that children should be raised by the biological mother 24/7, around the clock. She should be completely attuned to the needs of the child. More recently, which I can talk more about later, in the last 10 or 15 years, the ante's been up that she's supposed to be completely devoted and her life is to center upon the cognitive, behavioral, educational, psychological development of her child. It's just not enough to feed and clothe and hug your baby anymore. You have to raise the super child who will get into Harvard by 12 and, you know, discover the cure by cancer by 13 and read 3 languages by 5.
Well, it was really interesting, the interview with Andrea, because it was totally spontaneous. I saw her in the corridor at the University of Ottawa. I was there for a conference, and so was she. And she was actually selling books. And I had no intention of interviewing her, but she just seemed such a dynamic, lively person selling these books that I asked her whether I could interview her, and she said yes. So I think that motherhood is a really great example or expression of how we are controlled in Western society by capitalism, by globalization, by making us constantly feel insecure. We're never good enough. And the prime case where we're never good enough is as mothers. We never quite make the grade. And that was what I wanted to talk to her about.
When I talk about this to my students, they think this type of motherhood has been around forever. Children need this. They believe fundamentally this excessive child-centered, consumer, materialist-based mothering is necessary for children's well-being. And that's the first struggle, because in my work, I argue fundamentally this is not good for kids or for mothers. And I really try to get my students to think about motherhood outside of a biological, natural paradigm. And I say to them, there's nothing natural about motherhood. And they have great resistance to that. The point I simply try to make is the meaning of motherhood, how we are expected to mother, told to mother, is culturally determined. It changes radically throughout history, and the work I do is to try to put motherhood in historical context and to show my students, and in my own writing, how motherhood is constantly reinvented. So what was a good mother in 1950s, today, she would certainly not qualify as a good mother. She'd be considered a bad mother. And yet, in her time, a 1950s mother would be considered a good mother. But the standards of motherhood have changed fundamentally and radically in the last 20, 30, 40 years.
What was the economic event that changed it? You know, you were talking about the post-war
right.
years and the 50s and the 60s, where it was absolutely much more laid back, to the point where I am too ashamed to discuss my daughter's childhood with her. But then it changed again.
My argument and what I do in my research is I think it changed, began to change in the mid-1980s. We certainly saw the beginning of it earlier, but I really believe the 1970s was probably the best time to be a mother, because not only did you have relaxed motherhood, but now you had feminism too. Right. So what happens in the 80s that causes motherhood and eventually gives rise to what us scholars call intensive mothering, this highly competitive, completely regulatory mothering where if you're not a good mom, you're nothing, right? The standards have gone through the roof. Your child, as I said, has to speak three languages by five, has to read by one. Hyper, hyper competitive. More generally, the rise of consumerism and materialism more generally in the 80s, where class becomes marked through personal acquisition of wealth, right? Bigger homes, bigger cars, bigger vacations. And children become a status symbol. They become the new accessory that marks your class. And in the 50s, you marked your class by having a stay-at-home wife. You knew you made it to the middle class when you had a stay-at-home wife. Well, that doesn't become, that's not possible in the 80s anymore. With the two recessions we had, middle-class families have working wives. So you can't mark your class anymore by having your wife at home. So you marked your class through children. So the smarter child, the child with the best clothes, the best bedroom, the most stuff, becomes a marker of class mobility. And so that's one thing. I really think it's tied in with class. I think another big reason is simply demographics. Women started having fewer children in the 70s and 80s. And when I grew up, you know, I had three brothers and sisters, and we could play with each other. But no, most families have one or two children. So when children don't have children to play with, the mother becomes a playmate, or, you know, and the children don't grow up in childhood anymore. They grow up with their parent, usually the mother, as their best friend. And tied to that, then, if you only have one child, you've got just one chance to raise that perfect kid. Women are having children later, as we've never seen before in history. So women are having their first in their 30s. And I'm talking largely middle-class women, but these are highly professional women. Type A personality, they have to be to have made it in a man's world, whether they're lawyers, doctors, architects, professors. And when they come to mothering, they bring that excessive professionalism, that excessive desire to be in control to mother work. Before being a mother, her daytimer, her BlackBerry would be filled with meetings for court case or meetings for whatever. Now her daytimer or BlackBerry is filled with her children's appointments. So at 1:15, now there's gymboree classes, and at 2:17, there's music for mums and tots. So it's almost like this manic way to justify. And I feel for these women because they grew up with outside markers of success, education, paycheck, status in their career. And then these women are thrown into motherhood, which is the most devalued, underappreciated, invisible work. So they mark their success and achievement through their children. And they can then say to their husbands, well, what did you do all day, honey? I used to say, well, I kept them alive. That's good enough. But today mothers have to say, no, but look at Johnny did this and Susie did that. So they can prove they've been out in the public world that they've accomplished something. So it's almost this transference of their professional craziness onto their children. The final reason, I think, and this is what I write on, this new type of mothering, which is called intensive mothering, competitive mothering, or whatever you want to call it, I think it's a backlash to feminism. In the 70s and early 80s, there was a moment, so ever brief, that feminism, I think, we believe we did it. We had a moment. We were getting our post-secondary degrees. We're entering into professions that were unimaginable. And we really believed that we could do it, and we made it. And we were still mothers. My argument is under the more 50s or relaxed, which I call custodial mothering, you know, a little sunshine and some water and your children's just going to be fine. But under this intensive mothering, one thing is true. You can't be an intensive mother and be also in the paid labor force. They eliminate each other. So just as women were making huge strides in education, work, they raised the bar on motherhood and they said, no, you can't do both anymore. You have to choose, because under this discourse of motherhood, you really can't be both an intensive mother. And today, that's the only way you can mother. If you don't do it that way, you're a bad mother. Mothers used to be friends. Now they're enemies. They're competitors. One scholar said that motherhood is the new female Olympics, and I completely agree with her. Whose kid's the smartest? Who walks first? You know, who gets the best grades? Breaks up solidarity among women, this competitive mothering. Secondly, if you try to do it and work outside the home, you're exhausted. You're burnt out. And you're ridden with guilt, because you can never do both well. The standards are impossible to be a good mother today. No one can get there, even the rich, affluent, white, perfect woman. She's still a failure. So if you have a woman exhausted, isolated, overwhelmed, guilty, you have a disempowered woman. I mean, I think there's a third option. You can quit intensive motherhood. I do believe you can work outside the home and raise happy children. I've done it. Many of my friends have. But to do that, you have to give up intensive mothering. But women, believe they have to mother that way. So what they do is they leave the paid labor force, if they can, to be a good mother. Women now are returned to economic dependency on men, vulnerability as a result, and these are women who are highly educated and professional, and many of them are miserable. If you want to go back to full-time motherhood, all the power to you, but the majority of these women are bullied to go back in because they believe they have to do intensive mothering to be a good mother. And so they give up their paid jobs and follow through the script. Psychologists are now starting to write on this because these children raised by intensive mothering are now teenagers, and we are seeing the fallout of this type of mothering. We have children with higher rates of anxiety, you know, ADHD, depression. These children have never had to have a thought. They've never had to make a decision. They've had no agency. And then they grow up. I think we're in a crisis right now with our children who are now becoming adults because of this type of mothering. Do we need this? Are our children better off by going to soccer Monday night, piano Tuesday night? No, they're not. We have to return childhood to children. One of the reasons we have intense mothering, because we've lost community. Because my students always say, but kids can't play outside anymore because it's not safe. But we've created that unsafeness. So I think we have to reclaim our neighborhoods. We have to reclaim public space. We have to have children playing outside again, whether it's ball hockey or skipping. And I know it sounds nostalgic, but I don't think it has to be. And I have to say this type of intensive mothering is not happening in rural communities. They're still doing this other style. They have to. I think we have to step back and say, what have we done? This is not good for us or our children. I think we have to, I don't know what the word is, be more relaxed, more laid back, and just enjoy our children. Let them be kids. Of course, yes, you know, piano lesson Tuesday night, fine. But that doesn't mean you have to do violin on Wednesday and cello on Thursday. My children were raised in a rural community, and, you know, my children are fiercely independent. You know, they moved out of the house very young. They run a household. They're in university. And I think part of it is because, I mean, sure, I spent time with my children. I love my children. But I didn't micromanage them to the same degree. You know, I just said, go outside, play. We have livestock, go play with the goats. I mean, that's what children do. And I think that the mothers are starting to realize there is a backlash now against intensive mothering. And I think we have to let mothers be women, have careers, have partners, have leisure, have a life, and be a mother too. And it's certainly doable. Absolutely it is. Children don't need all that stuff. I turned out okay, and I was left in a playpen. My brother's fine. He was tied to a tree. Everything's okay. So I think we really believe that if we do all this, we're going to raise perfect children. And the thing is, we're not. You can do everything perfect and still have failed children. And you can do everything wrong and still raise good kids. Motherhood is the ultimate gamble. My term I use is empowered mothering or feminist mothering. We don't have to sacrifice ourselves as human beings to be a good mother. I think we have to go back to a more community-based, less competitive, less excessive form of mothering that allows women to be a good mother, quotation marks, but also have a full and meaningful life outside of motherhood.
The ideal of motherhood is, of course, a myth. Both motherhood and beauty are myths that are ingrained in women from the earliest age. As women age and active child-rearing is finished, there are other issues that emerge. The representation of older women in the media continues this myth surrounding how women are supposed to be. Josie Dolan is a retired professor in film studies and a researcher in British cinema and women in film. We talked about the representation of older women in the media and her own experience of growing old and the cultural pressures that fall upon us all.
Josie Dolan, you and I both come from more or less the same place. We come from the north of England from working-class background.
We do, and I can't believe that we've met in Montreal. Because, you know, I heard your accent and I felt at home. You sound like Coronation Street as well.
Both of us grew up going to the cinema all the time, which we call the pictures.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And I think one of the things we've talked about in the past is the fact that there was the children's pictures on Saturday morning, and then there were the matinees that you could get into, often on your own, even without your parents. If parents today did it, they'd get locked up, child abuse, you know. But so times have changed that way. But that pleasure going to the pictures. And it was about not just the films, it was actually the physical environment. It was the warmth of the cinema, the luxury of the seating. And then, of course, the magic when the curtains opened and the picture was up there on the screen. It's just magical.
In those days, really the most beautiful things that we ever saw were some of those interiors from California and, of course, the beautiful bodies of the Hollywood stars.
Oh, of course, of course. If we're thinking about the Golden Age, you know, from Jean Harlow onwards, if we're thinking about the women, as I've grown older, is for many, many years, the men were allowed to grow old, but the women weren't. You know, you get that situation once the female star started to hit her menopause, she disappeared from the screen, or she got to pay the mum. Whereas, like with the older stars, the men, their careers continued with ever, ever younger stars. You know, if you look at Fred Astaire, for instance, not even a sex idol, but a great dancer. His leading ladies just got younger and younger till he ended up, he was like a 60-year-old man, paired with an 18-year-old young woman. So it's been very, very different for women in Hollywood.
I first met Josie actually in Montreal and in a conference organised by the communications department at Concordia University. And Josie, I knew right away I had to interview her because she was that very rare person that I would meet in my life who was from the same social background that I was from in the UK. Josie was a working class woman who, fighting like crazy, managed to make it out of her destiny. She chose another destiny, and the destiny that she chose was that of an educated, confident woman who worked in a university.
As a researcher, what's interested me since round about 2000 in Hollywood, older women have started to gain attention. Let's talk about the Oscars. How often do we see older women? Meryl Streep, Helen Mirren, Judy Dench, Diane Keaton, Glenn Close, and so on and so on. It's the older women who are gaining the attention.
These are older women, and they're very physically exceptional, aren't they? What do you think that does to us, especially when we were younger, for instance, of seeing these totally stunning women, these stunning physical bodies, and not having them ourselves?
Well, I don't want to generalise about all women in all places, but I certainly internalised it. I always thought of myself as an ugly woman. You know, I had the wrong hair, had the wrong... Oh, God, I've got freckles. I've got big hips. You know, I also had the wrong body shape. I mean, actually, when I look back at photographs of myself as a young woman, I think, what the hell was I worrying about? Yeah. But you know, but I think that still prevails, because it's not just about seeing Hollywood stars at the cinema. We see them on chat shows, we see them in magazines, we see the lookalikes and the fashion slides. So we're constantly being told that this is the ideal that we should be aspiring for, and if you're not making it, you're nothing. And I think we all live with those contradictions, because we can all be critical of Jane Fonda, we all know how stupid it is, and yet there's that little voice inside of us telling us
we would love to look like Jane Fonda.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the Jane Fonda we know, the one we see, is an image. What does the real Jane Fonda feel like when she looks in the mirror?
You know, anxious,
of course, yeah, and that constant work to look good. You know, there's something about, I think it was Jermaine Gray said, that there's a moment when letting yourself go is such a relief, you know, that you can actually allow yourself to let yourself go in certain ways and worry less about your appearance. The pressure that Hollywood puts on its female stars to remain young and beautiful, and then the vilification of them for trying, and they go hand in hand. And even now, I don't know if you've ever followed any of the press around Madonna, but certainly in the UK, she's absolutely demonised and vilified for exposing her body because she's too old, and how dare she show her body. God forbid she's got gnarled hands, you know. And the British press especially have seized on her hands as the fact that no matter how much work she does on her body, the hands will give you away. And yet, the same newspapers are talking about Helen Mirren and showing photographs of Helen Mirren in a bikini, saying how gorgeous she is and how wonderful she is. So only some kinds of older flesh can be exposed.
So what's the difference between Helen and Madonna?
Well, on the one hand, well, of course, Madonna's American, if we're talking about the UK. OK, there is that one. But there's also the fact that Helen Mirren claims not to have had any work done, that she's got her fabulous body, from hours of work in the gym, regulating her body that way, but she's never had plastic surgery. She's as nature made her. Whereas Madonna, like Cher, has been upfront about having surgery and having work done. So I think there's an immense pleasure in saying, well, she's spent all that money, but still not working.
I think also maybe the personas that they inhabit. I mean, Helen Mirren is more of the good girl. Madonna tended to challenge all kinds of sexual norms, didn't she?
Well, I think that's part of it. And as she tries to continue that, I mean, she was always famous for the fetishisation and the sexual gestures. And I'm not particularly a fan of Madonna's, but I hate the things that get said about her and the way they get written. This vile scrutiny of her body, looking for the signs of the rejuvenation techniques breaking down. And I actually think that's a marker of a real cultural anxiety around rejuvenation, because what happens when that no longer works and the real old person underneath starts being revealed? Because what does old age signify in Western cultures?
Death.
Death. And the real anxiety is about death. The young body is denying the approach of death. And in fact, it's the only thing we've got in common in the human condition. From the moment we're conceived, we're on our way to death. And yet we endlessly, endlessly deny it. That's why they don't want, particularly old female stars, because A, they're not fertile, they're not reproducing anymore, whereas the old men can still do that. If you can still, with the help of Viagra, get it up, you can still reproduce. So there's not the same anxiety. A woman has no purpose if she's not reproducing, so she might as well be dead. So pretending to look young is about pretending to be still reproductive. The counter side of that, of course, is when you see an old woman. I wish the listeners could see my hands, because I'm endlessly saying, I'm qualifying this, I don't really mean this. This is a dominant cultural attitude. When rejuvenation breaks down, and it's mostly women who do rejuvenation, it's a reminder that we're all on our way to the grave. And it's scary, because we have no narratives, no stories, no telling to make it feel better. In the old days, when religion was the norm, no matter how regulatory, how disciplining a religion was, or still is for those within religious belief systems, there's still that belief that there's something waiting for you afterwards, that your life hasn't been in vain, that you're not simply on the scrap heap, the compost heap of life, that actually there will be some continuity. But if you've not got that belief, how scary is death? Because it's just an end.
When we were going to the movies, you know, in the 50s when we were kids, the only images that we had were cinematic images, really. We didn't have great big billboards with ads on. We didn't have any internet or anything like that, of course. There seemed to be less anxiety, and old women were just old women. They didn't seem to try to look young in those days. Am I just remembering the Hollywood and the palm trees and the beauty of Charlie Chaplin films and the Keystone Cops and all that, you know, where the sun always shone? Is it just me remembering wrong?
I don't think you're remembering wrong, but I think the thing here is the whole thing about money and wealth. Wealthy women have always been able to stay younger looking. A, they didn't get sick because they had enough food, they had access to medicine, they had access to good childbirthing care, they had access to good clothes, good makeup, good dentistry, a whole range of reasons why they stayed looking young.
And they didn't work.
Of course they didn't work. Well, they worked at looking good. So the women that we lived with and saw in our daily lives had lost their teeth because they'd worked in some horribly polluted factory. They'd had children without proper care. They had prolapses. You know, it was amazing they were surviving, never mind looking good. Yeah. I mean, and I know, I always thought that women were old at 40 because they looked old at 40 where I lived, because they'd not had enough to eat and too many babies. I think part of what we're talking about is the big transformation of women's lives that's happened over the last 30, 40 years. But if you go to Indigenous communities, to the real working class communities that are still around, I live in the city of Glasgow in the UK, and if I go into certain areas, the women there look like the women of my childhood. It's like my middle class delusion that things have changed. It's my social context that's changed, not the opportunity for women. because the Hollywood women are still beautiful and gorgeous and perfect. In spite of my feminism, I'm still influenced by it.
When you think about the future, this business of body image and appearance, do you see any changes? Are women going to continue with the Botox?
I think the women who've got the money will. I actually think this is going to become the new marker of wealth. It's like it used to be the fur coat, it used to be the perfectly groomed hair. It's already become the marker of wealth. If you go to New York City, to the wealthy areas, that the facelift is so normal that if you've not had it done, you look peculiar. And that's because they've got the money to do it. And I think one of the funny contradictions about all of this is actually the facelift, the rejuvenation, doesn't actually make you look younger. It makes you look as if you've had work done. The late Joan Rivers was the RIP, she's just died, was the perfect example of this. It's a way of displaying your wealth. I can afford to get this done.
Those women, they must have quite difficult lives, though. Having to look 40 when you're 80.
Yeah. Well, the thing I can never understand is the actual pain of surgery. Why would anybody elect to have surgery that wasn't necessary? Or even Botox, having a deadly poison put into your body. It does not compute for me. So the mindset that thinks, A, it's a good thing, and B, that it's normal, is really troubling. What's the really sad about this, though, Rose, is that 40, 50 years of feminism, it's... What's it, 40 years since Naomi Wolf wrote The Beauty Myth? We're still trapped in it. We thought we'd cracked it, but we haven't.
You were just listening to episode one of Older Women Live, the podcast. On this episode, you heard Dr. Andrea O'Reilly and Dr. Josie Dolan. Older Women Live is produced by Michelle Macklem and me, Rosemary Wally. Older Women Live is a production of Aging Communications Technology and CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, Canada. Music in this episode is by Poddington Bear. You can listen to more episodes by subscribing on iTunes or visiting our website at actproject.ca/owl.